This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Bald Move Prestige. We got a great film for you today. It's 2002's autobiographical. No, it's not autobiographical. It's just biographical.
Semi-biographical.
Maybe, yeah, well, we'll get to that. Catch Me If You Can. This film was directed by Steven Spielberg. It was written by Jeff Nathanson. It's based on the book Catch Me If You Can by Frank Abagnale and Stan Redding. And it's got music by Johnny Williams, Jazzy Johnny Williams, not doing your traditional marches and all that kind of stuff. Just doing a damn fine kind of jazzy, breezy score. I really liked it. This movie stars everybody. Leonardo DiCaprio as Frank Abagnale, Tom Hanks as Carl Hanratty, the FBI agent that chases him down throughout the movie. Christopher Walken was big back then. I forgot how, like, he was in everything. As Frank's dad, Martin Sheen is in this movie as a big, scary dad lawyer. Amy Adams, fresh-faced, braced-faced Amy Adams is in this movie. One of her first roles, I believe. James Brolin is in this movie. Jennifer Garner is in this movie. Elizabeth Banks is in this movie. The real Frank Abagnale is in this movie. Did you know that, Jim?
Oh, no. Where is he?
He's one of the French police officers that throws cuffs on Leo at the end, which is pretty cool. Pretty cool detail. It has a very cool credit sequence. I hadn't seen it. I saw this movie quite a few times. I think I had it on DVD and I was really enamored in film back in the day. And I watched it like 5 or 6 times. I hadn't seen it in probably 15 years. Wow. What a fun movie. What'd you think of it?
Yeah, that's the impression I had the first time I watched it. And again, when I watched it this time, I forgot that Steven Spielberg directed this thing. So when I saw his name on it, I was like, OK, this is maybe not like the finest thing Steven Spielberg has ever made, but it has that like effortlessly watchable quality that all of his movies do.
Yeah, he didn't phone this in he's Steven Spielberg, this motherfucker. And I understand that it was kind of like a almost not exactly a lark, but like back in the late 80s, early 90s, DreamWorks SKG, or I think is what it is, bought the movie rights to Frank's biography, Catch Me If You Can. And Gore Verbinski wanted to do it. And then I kid, there's a couple other kind of darling directors that kind of lined up, and the availability of different stars. At one point, James Gandolfini was going to be the FBI agent, which would have been cool. And it just kind of kept on being in limbo. And then like Leonardo did the Scorsese film Gangs in New York, and that took him off the board. And there's a brief window where everything kind of lined up and Spielberg kind of like, well, fuck it, I'll direct it. And wow, he really does. Like, there's so much great Spielberg stuff. Like some really cool like POV shots. And just, you know, getting a great natural performance out of Leo, who's playing pretty young in this film.
Yeah,
I thought it did a great job. And again, Johnny Williams, you know, not doing his typical Johnny Williams stuff. That's the thing. Everyone says, Johnny Williams songs all sound the same. And they only cite like Star Wars, Superman and Raiders. It's like, yeah, Schindler's List does not sound like that, man. Catch Me If You Can does not sound. This is a classically trained jazz musician born of a jazz drummer. A father. He knows his way around a lot of different music, and he crushed it on this.
Yeah.
You know, this is a pretty light and breezy and effortlessly watchable film, but there's a lot more darkness and melancholy. You know, now that I'm seen as an older man, there's a lot of like sadness. Like this is essentially kind of like an adult Home Alone. It's a Christmas movie, number one.
Sure. Yeah.
Way more of a Christmas movie than I would have ever suspected. Easily could go on your annual Christmas watch if you're just judging by how much Christmas lights, how much heartfelt Christmas scenes are in it, how much Christmas music is in it. And it's about a little boy who gets left kind of behind by his family, runs away, and scams his way through a life of crime squatting in places that aren't his. Like, it's very, you know, Kevin McAllister, right?
Sure. Yeah. Now that you mention it, that's kind of a pretty apt description of this movie. And a lot of my big questions about this film come, and there aren't a ton of questions to ask. Like, the movie is not to be, you know, examined too closely, but like, why does Frank Abagnale Jr. do the things he does? Why does he live this life of scamming? And I think it is, you know, several things probably brought together here, but I was hoping we could discuss that later in the podcast.
Yeah. Do you want to, I guess now we've had our general thoughts out of the way, maybe we should tell people about what this film is about, and then sure. they can, because again, if you haven't seen this movie, it's nearing 20 years old. It'll be 20 years old next year, which shocks me, always shocks me when I'm confronted with the reality of my physical age. But if you haven't seen it, it's a great time. And the setup is Frank Abagnale Jr. is one of the most prolific and successful con men in American history. He at a very young age, like, he started scamming like at 15, but at between 17 and like 21, he stole millions of dollars from corporations such as Pan Am, various hospitals, by essentially highly sophisticated social engineering and check fraud. Mm-hmm. And he is chased down by an FBI agency who is just now kind of like getting the fact that this is, like, you know, you can tell that a lot of FBI agents think this bank fraud detail is bullshit. Like, they joined the service to chase down robbers.
Yeah.
You know,
have shootouts in the street or something, like.
Yeah. Like, they want to find the next John Dillinger and mm-hmm. gun him down. And they're kind of like, this is the way things are now. Yeah. And this kid is just chased literally all over the country and all over the world. But he's FBI agents. He stays one step ahead of him. And the question, catch me if you can these people catch him? So, yeah, I think it's really interesting. I've never seen a take on this. It reminds me kind of like those like the movies, like what was it called? Like Taking the House, about the MIT blackjack guys. Like, it's essentially, yes, this is crime and there are victims, and some of the victims are a little bit more poignant than others. But most of the victims are like giant institutions, and it's literally a child. So it's like one of those things where it's like the rare crime that you can kind of, like, no one gets killed. Mm-hmm. No one even gets seriously injured. It's like one is rare where it's like just swashbuckling. It's exciting to watch this kid just with guts and balls. And oh, my God, the guts and balls this kid have in some of these scenes. Yeah. So that's the pitch, if you haven't seen it.
And it was a very successful movie at the time. We said it's not, you know, Spielberg's biggest movie or whatever, but it made $300 million more than its budget of $52 million. So by all rights, like, making six times your money is pretty damn successful. And it was nominated for a couple awards. Not really the film itself, but the music. John Williams was nominated for Best Original Score that year. He lost to a movie called Frida, which I haven't seen. And then Best Supporting Actor, Christopher Walken.
He lost to a movie called Frida?
Frida.
Oh, Frida. Oh, okay. Yeah. The Frida Kahlo story. I was like, what the Frida? What the fuck? I don't even remember that.
Yeah, he lost to a Frito-Lay's commercial. Yeah, it was unfortunate.
Damn it, Johnny. Maybe better luck next time.
And Christopher Walken lost to Chris Cooper in Adaptation. So I could see it.
And the other thing is, like, Christopher Walken, kind of a shaky nomination for Best Supporting Actor.
I think, like, he's fantastic in this movie.
He is, but he's in like 5 minutes of it.
Sure. It's not a big part, but it is. It's so Christopher Walken, you mentioned him being big at the time, and he was, but he was Christopher Walken, right? He's like that thing that you think of as Christopher Walken was just starting to, like, bloom. And I think everybody was like starting to think of Christopher Walken as that guy who does the silly voice and the weird mannerisms.
I hid this movie is not hunk of metal. Up my ass.
Cowbell. For 15 years. And, putting watches up your ass. All that. This is not that Christopher Walken. This is the serious, like, Deer Hunter actor Christopher Walken being extremely charismatic and able to bring, like, a deep sadness when he needs to on the screen. I was very impressed by his performance.
You're right. Maybe I'm being, because, like, you know, if you're going to give what's Hannibal Lecter,
Anthony Hopkins,
we're going to give him, you know, a best supporting actor nod for his 5 minutes of work in Silence of the Lambs, and then maybe give it to Walken here. The other thing is, like, Walken brings a lot of the tools that he doesn't get to flex a lot. Like, he dances in this movie, and he's like a classically trained, very good actor or dancer. I don't know if I can't remember the
style.
The music video that he's in a couple years back that kind of like blew his spot Moby? Up where he yeah was that what it was I couldn't remember if it was
yeah I think it was a Moby video
but he does like this like whole routine and he's like really charming and he gets to do that in this movie so yeah maybe he does deserve it. And that's the emotional core of this movie is between you know Frank and his son.
Yeah,
and it's also between Frank Jr. and the FBI agent. Mm-hmm. So for those to work, you got to have a really good actor. Speaking of, Tom Hanks is fantastic in this movie.
Incredible.
Playing this like sawed off Boston kid that is like a super FBI nerd in this giant, you know, growing financial crimes division that nobody really respects. And like somebody on Twitter, it's like when I was talking about this being a low key Christmas movie, said, I liked it when he's fodging the checks because Tom Hanks is you're fodging the checks there, Frankie. It's a really winning Tom Hanks role, too.
Yeah. And the things I appreciate about Tom Hanks are in full display here. It's the little touches with Tom Hanks. Like he can go very broad and very funny. But he's also able to bring a lot of that just through the smallest things. Like there's a scene where he's chasing down Frank in a motel. He thinks he's got him in his room and he's going down the hall and he points his gun at the housekeeper or whatever. And she like freaks out and he whips out his badge to show it to her. But when he opens it up, it's backwards. Like she can't even see it. And he's not paying attention. He's just like flipping his badge up at her. FBI lady, whatever.
Sweeping her with the gun, like sticking a gun on her. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so great. Good.
That's one he's of the so best, honestly, one of the best scenes in the whole movie. And the one that I thought has got the biggest laughs, just, you know, he's got Frank caught dead to rights. And Frank in like 60 seconds convinces him that he is a Secret Service agent that got the collar 5 minutes before, and he uses all this stuff. Like it is kind of genius, like this relationship with this neighbor, blind neighbor and his son. And the fact that he knows so much about like the equipment, though, he convinces this seasoned FBI officer that he's a Secret Service agent and gets away scot-free. One of the many times he does.
Yeah. And DiCaprio, so good in that scene. I mean, the way like when he's facing Tom Hanks, you know, Carl Hanratty, he's cool and calm and composed and just smooth as butter. And then he turns away to the camera and you can almost see him shaking, right? That he's like,
yeah,
this is either I'm either going to prison here or this is going to work. And he doesn't know which.
You know, we've talked about Leonardo's a really great ability to demonstrate very strong emotion. Like, you know, I've said, like, I don't know what it feels like to realize your wife drowned your children, but it probably looks a little something like what he did on Shutter Island. I don't know how it feels to see your wife like jump out of a window right in front of you, but it probably looks a little bit like what he does in Inception.
Yeah.
He's very good at portraying a person that wheels are turning and spinning. Mm-hmm. Like there's a couple of things in this movie where he has to carry 60 seconds of just Frank putting details together about a situation. And like, it's only interesting because of what Leo's bringing to it. And he's so good at just like showing him calculating the angles and, you know, trying to read the person and see what is the thing to say. And sometimes he goes, it's funny because there's a couple times in the movie where I think he tries the level, but the other person doesn't get it. And like, he's like, you know, like, oh, I'm just going to give up charade and tell the truth. But the other person, it's interpreted as like a joke.
Yeah.
Or like a misunderstanding because, you know, he's carried himself again. It is hard. OK, can we talk about this for a minute? It is hard to believe that a 17-year-old did all of these things.
Yeah. What is your read? I don't know if Leo complicates that or if he enhances that idea, because he's like, he's like a 30-year-old or something. He's roughly 30-ish years old at this point.
And he doesn't, when he's asked to be a 15-year-old boy in the first part of the movie, he it doesn't work super well.
Yeah, they sweep his bangs down like that's going to help give him a boy cut.
And they make him sit in a twin size mattress with, like, you know, the covers pulled up to his chin so that he looks like a little.
It almost works. Like, it's it almost close. Does. For a 28-year-old guy to be playing that young, it's shocking how well it does work.
But and honestly, like, Titanic era. Right? Titanic era Leo would have crushed it, even though he was like 24 at that time, too.
Right,
he's got a bit of a baby face.
He does. He looks young. And I don't know if that helps or hurts, because when I'm these people behind, you know, the desk at the Pan Am, you know, airline desk, or I'm, you know, one of the doctors who's interviewing him looking across at this hospital, I'm thinking this kid looks real young. And I imagine the real Frank Abagnale probably looked older than he actually was, right? Whereas this kid, you know, kind of looks the age that he's playing in this movie. So I don't know. It's a little bit like harder to believe when you put Leonardo DiCaprio, who looks so young, in that role.
Have you ever? So I don't know if I've said this before, but I actually met Frank at a cybersecurity conference about 15 years ago. He did an hour keynote address on, like,
Fodgeries.
He did it on
social engineering.
Social engineering. Thank you. What's the human side of hacking?
Yeah.
And he was also signing book, giving away copies of his books and signing. And in the hotel room later, he's like just like really interesting guy. And in the hotel room later, I was like leafing through, and he credits, I guess, that he, like, his hair was graying in high school. He's one of those ones that was like going gray. So, like, okay. Yes, he did look baby face, but also the early graying. And I guess his hair maybe started thinning as well. So he did look older than
that
you would expect.
Total sense. Yeah.
And also, just in the 60s, if you roll up in, like, a airline uniform, the idea that you would go through all the hoops required, which, that's the other thing, people greatly estimate how many hoops there were in front of people at the time. It just kind of carried the day. And with his kind of natural charisma and kind of like acting like you belong there, and it carried the day.
Quick
now,
thinking.
Having said that, apparently this movie is fairly accurate to the book, but there's a lot of questions about the accuracy of the biography that he co-wrote with this guy. And boy, the layers of trying to uncover what's the truth when you're talking about the biography of a con man.
Yeah.
who was pretending to be a pilot, a doctor, a lawyer before he's even in his 20s. Like, I don't, that's how do you even do the investigation behind that?
I don't know how you would. I've read a little bit of the wiki article on this movie, and Frank was saying, like, oh yeah, they embellished a few things, like I was not an only child, his mother never got remarried, things like that, which add an emotional punch to this movie that I think, you know,
sure did.
Spielberg, and this is the thing we always talk about, like, oh, how, you know, you're writing a movie and you get to this point where you need something, but it's not real enough. Well, guys like Steven Spielberg, they just add it in because it makes the movie better. It's not about, you know, being true to reality. You can call it based on a true story and then just run.
Or
with
this
it.
Was inspired. Like, that's the thing. It's like based is, but then if you go inspired by a true story, then you can make up. Because there's a lot, like, for example, there's no FBI agent named what is it, Carl?
Hanratty.
It was some other dude that didn't want his name being used, so they changed a couple details with that, and I guess they changed a lot of stuff to make that more emotionally resonant, because in real life, like, if the details, I think, of the crimes are pretty specific, but a lot of the personal details that give it that emotional core, because at the end, that's an interesting question, because I can't tell you why the real Frank Abagnale Jr. did the things he did, but the movie makes a pretty compelling case.
Yeah.
Which, again, is fictionalized, but, like, it's and this is something that Spielberg loves to traffic in, the effects of broken homes, you know, strained relationships between parents, strained relationships between children wanting to be looked up and respect. I mean, this goes back to fucking Indiana Jones. Like, sure, his ultimate arc was for his dad to love him and for him to, you know, love his father.
Yeah.
He loves that shit, and it works really well in this movie. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in a club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Yeah, maybe now's as good a time to get into it as any. I definitely think there are multiple aspects to it. One of those being, like, he's running from this decision he has to make, right? And then this broken home that you're talking about. There's a scene in the movie where he's asked to decide which parent he wants to live with. And instead of doing that, he just runs, literally runs right away from the situation. Right. And you get the feeling that throughout the course of this entire movie, that's one of the things he's running from. The other thing is, like, you know, trying to make your parents proud of you. I get the feeling like it's a little bit of that, but it's also like it's sort of seeing the things that his dad has and the life that his dad has created, right? Being honored at the Rotary Club, you know, having these nice Cadillacs. He's kind of obsessed with Cadillacs through this whole movie. Mm-hmm. All these things that, like, were in his father's life, you can tell that he is not exactly envious of, but he wants for himself, and he knows that his father would want for him too, and he's kind of chasing that down. And then it's tragic when it all, you know, comes crashing down, as it inevitably will. It comes crashing down on Frank Abagnale Sr.'s part, and Junior has to look at that, and he meets several times with his dad after he's run away, and his life seems to be getting worse and worse, right? At first it was just, oh, well, the tax collectors are after him, whatever, and he brushes it off. And then, you know, he's got to sell the Cadillac, and he brushes that off, and then his wife leaves him, brushes that off. It's just a downward spiral.
By the end, he doesn't even have, like, it's the pinstripe suit. He doesn't even have that. He's wearing, like, a post office worker's, you know, he's got nothing. Which there's an interesting wrinkle about all that. But there is a little bit of, like, this kind of, like, royalty and exile, like an Anastasia kind of Romanoff feel of this boy who is, like, a prince, right? His dad is, like, the president of the Rotary Club. He's got this respected department store. He's got this beautiful, glamorous wife. They have this big, you know, not mansion, but well-off home in the 50s and 60s for sure. He's going to a private academy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got the little crest on his lapel pocket. He's going to Rushmore. And then he loses it. And there's like this idea of like him. He's kind of like one of Targaryens walking around in Essos trying to regain his crown. Like he want all the things that were taken from his dad, a great man.
Yeah.
But I saw a really interesting take on, I think it was r/truefilm, the like movie snob Reddit, where this guy had a really interesting take of like, because I thought that like Leonardo got this like desperation gambit from his dad that was like, you know, this low stakes confidence scheme. And like and that was like the first time. His dad is usually a pretty, you know, straight edge kind of guy. But, you know, he lost a little bit and something's gone wrong in the store and he got behind his taxes. But this guy laid out a compelling case that like this guy might have had his whole life be a lie as well. Like, you know. It's really easy to imagine Senior? Frank Sr. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In
fully
Paris, France, getting this lady to go back to America with him and saying, oh, yeah, I'm rich and I've got this and my dad owns that. And he's like running confidence scams to kind of like get this lifestyle. And you're seeing Frank Sr. crash and burn. Frank Jr. doesn't know any of this. Like, none of this is like text in the movie. It's all subtext, but it kind of checks out because, like, he keeps on making shit up. Like, by the end of the movie, he's a Medal of Honor winner that's being unfairly. Like, I don't think he won the Medal of Honor for whatever he did in France. He's, you know, like, he just is making all these outlandish claims. There's a weird energy between him and his boy, too. Like, like some kind of pride mixed with shame that his son is like eclipsing him. And but also this like proud defiance that he's sticking it to the man. It's a really interesting complex, but I like the idea that like Frank Jr. and Frank's wife are kind of like victims of these confidence scams, too, that like he's always just puffed himself up until he ran out of runway.
Absolutely.
And how that would.
That's. Yeah, 100%.
Leo, like trying to chase his father's accomplishments that were also fraudulent, leads him into a fraudulent life. I think that's really fascinating material.
And his kid is definitely more successful at it than he is. I don't think Frank Abagnale Sr. ever had $4 million at a time, suitcases full of money. I think he was like living at his means. You know, he's got a stationery store or whatever. Like that's not going to bring in that kind of money, right? He was successful enough to make a life. His son is making 10 lives, literally. Yeah.
He's Walter. He's the Walter White of check fraud and check cashing schemes. That's an interesting scene. That scene where because at this point in his career, he's like like every single time he feels the heat, like he runs this airline scam. That's like his first one, you know, because like first he tries to do just basic check kiting 101. You know, write a check at one bank, deposit it, then write a check at another bank, deposited it. And just kind of like, you know, since banks at that time were actually mailing checks around and moving things around manually, it's like you had a week or two. He learned a few things about routing numbers. So the checks would go from New York all the way to California and it gave him 2 weeks of runtime. But then eventually he ran into like he'd gone to every bank in town and nobody like he kept on having to use fake IDs. And, you know, then he's like, OK, I need a persona where people just wouldn't even cross their mind. That I'm fraudulent. He hits on like these kind of archetypes like airline pilots who were kind of like these larger than life heroic figures back in the, you know, post World War II period. Doctors, lawyers. And he's got this situation with Amy Adams where, you know, he's convince people that he's a doctor. And the movie gets real sketchy here because someone could die. And he points out in the book that he got in a situation that really scared him, that he thought he might end up killing somebody because he was the attending doctor at this graveyard shift at this podunk hospital. And every once in a while, you know, you might have to save the residents there don't know what the fuck to do and you have to do something. Yeah. But he's got this thing where he does have suitcases full of like banded up money. Mm-hmm. Why didn't he ever just try to go legit at some point? Or stop scamming.
I was just thinking, like, go to Cuba. You've got $1.4 million. Go to Cuba. Just retire there. Like, go to South America. Go to the Philippines. I don't know. Go somewhere and just retire. Get out of this. There's an addiction to it, though. I think certainly it's not just that you have nothing and you want to make something. It's that there's an excitement to it. And you get addicted to that lifestyle. You can tell, like, when he's walking down the street in that pilot's uniform and everybody is turning their head, right? And they're looking at him. This is the Cadillac that his dad had, right? The fancy house that his dad had. That people, getting the respect from people, I think, is the thing that is really pushing him forward. And that excitement of, like, there's also something about the chase. Like, he wouldn't call Hanratty on Christmas Eve if he didn't enjoy the chase a little bit.
And fundamentally, just very lonely, you know, like there's that one point where it's great, where Tom Hanks realizes, like, why are you calling me on Christmas? I know it's because you've got nobody.
Yeah.
I'm the closest thing to a friend you've got. And that's where a lot of the Christmas flavor, because I'm not making it up. Like 20% of this movie is Christmas.
Sure.
You know, at least four, maybe five full on Christmas music, lights, Christmas trees, the works. But there is that like thrill of the chase, because Tom Hanks towards the end of the movie, when it turns out, of course, he is caught because you know it like a life of crime. It's like, you know, there's old criminals, bold criminals. There's no bold old criminals. Well, Leonardo proves that in this movie. And at the end where he's caught, he's been in prison for a few years. Tom Hanks has worked to get him like on a work release program where he serves out the rest of the term at the FBI. And there's a lot of, you know, this is where Spielberg really shines, like the way he just effortlessly tells the internal feelings of Leonardo's character. Frank got the Venetian blinds are shining on his face, putting bars on him, giving him convict stripes. And he's feeling like really hemmed in. And he goes to pull one last heist and Tom Hanks meets him at the airport. And it's like, come on, Frank, you're going to be back on Monday. And he's like, why do you think that? He's like, because nobody's chasing you. Because he does. He's got, there's no way, there's nowhere he can go without instantly being caught. He's got no more runway. And sure enough, he shows back up the next Monday and he transmutes the thrill of the chase into the thrill of the hunt. And then he becomes, he serves out, like, by all accounts, the rest of his life in civilian service, being one of the foremost experts on catching check fraud and beefing up security systems and that stuff.
I'm torn on this kind of stuff. Not so much that, like, I think that's actually a useful thing to put your skills to. But I don't know. In a weird way, it's like, oh, you can be such a successful criminal that you have a job waiting for you if you're good enough at it. Like, it's real weird in that way. And it gets even grosser. And here's the part where I draw the line is profiting off of the crime in the future by selling rights to your story, by, you know, being invited to speak at conferences about these things. Like, that's where things get icky to me, is if I don't know. I almost feel like if there ought to be a law where if you get convicted of a crime, you cannot sell the rights to that. It becomes like public domain or something, to where you don't actually profit off of it.
And I think with like criminal, like not white collar civil criminals, that is the case, because, like, you know, I know OJ Simpson's,
I don't draw a huge distinction. Like, you're gonna tell me, like, bankrupting pension funds on Wall Street, I'm not going, I was just the same,
because I'm gonna agree with you. I'm gonna get around to agreeing with you, but because I know that, like, OJ Simpson, the family of Nicole Brown, was able to take all of his profits from his book. I know that, like, Manson was always trying to make a buck after his off of his thing, and like they were the victims were always able to garnish all that kind of stuff. So hey, you want to make some money for the victims? Go for it.
Sure.
I do think it's different here because it's a kid. And also, but the thing that's galling is, like, imagine if every kid that gets mixed up in a life of crime out of desperation or loneliness or whatever got taken in by a kindly police officer and given a mission and a purpose and a second chance,
right,
to pay back society. It's like I'm not even mad because I'm like, this is rehabilitative justice, you know, like, mm-hmm. you turn a person that was like going to steal and take everything to a person that's producing and helping people in society. That's like the golden standard. The thing that's galling is, yeah, you know, if he was making do by selling dime bags of weed, especially if he was black, he wouldn't get the Tom Hanks kindly FBI agent taking you under the wing because we bonded over our Christmas chats treatment, you know? So it's like, yeah, I think that's actually aspirational for the justice system. It's just such an outlier in how things get treated that it seems. And also, America's fuck. The reason that he got that is because the almighty dollar, like, he can help these guys save banks and companies and all these other, you know. So, and
like I said, I'm kind of okay with that part. Like, if you want to, you know, do something good with the skills that you've acquired at that point, that's fine. I'm just, when it comes to
profiting,
making money off the crimes themselves, right? Like, oh, I'm selling the stories of these crimes and making money off of that. That should probably not be allowed.
Yeah. I really like they show Spielberg is so good at visual storytelling. Like, there's entire stretches of the movie where you're just watching Leo like probe at weaknesses and discover new tricks and get doors slammed in his face, but then learn how to open those doors, and these like really cool montage sequences. There's like four or five of them. And they work because Leonardo DiCaprio turns out is a really good actor. This is one of the movies that started turning me around, because I hadn't seen Gangs of New York yet. That probably would have turned it. But I'm like, well, this is a pretty boy actor. You know, this is like a Jason Priestley type. I don't know if I'll ever take him seriously as an actor. And then I took him seriously at this. I'm like, okay, this is a guy who can act. Mm-hmm. But I also wondered, like, well, is he ever going to like be able to take on like a man role, like not like a boy role or something like that, right? And then like he started creating, you know, turns out he starts like looking older, and I feel like he's kind of like a modern De Niro at this stage in his career. Like, Aviator is the one I remember. Aviator and The Departed are the ones that I'm like, oh yeah, he's just actually going to fucking be like, I'm going to watch this guy in his 70s and 80s probably.
Yeah,
he's like a Jack Nicholson, Robert De Niro type.
Paul Newman, sure. Yeah.
Which is really amazing, given that he started as like this kind of heartthrob, you know?
Yeah. All over the cover of like a 17 magazine or whatever. And just.
Yeah. Teen Beat, all Tiger Beat, whatever they were.
I think he did have like a sort of extended boyish career because of his looks.
Sure.
You know, I mean, he's a really good looking guy, but he looks very young. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also just like the mechanics of it. Like, I love like the, you know, his first scam involved, it's like soaking bathtubs full of Pan Am planes to get the decal off so he could make the check look official, and how he's like, you know, making the typewriter look sloppy like it would be a mass produced check. There's also just like, man, Spielberg's so fucking great. There's this scene where you see tellers like counting out money, and at first they start off with Washingtons, and it goes to Lincolns, and then it goes to Jeffersons, and it goes to Benjamins, and it just effortlessly shows how his scams are going up in complexity and scale.
Yeah,
because of the amount of the checks he's able to cash. It's like it's you know, like, I never noticed this when I watched it 15 years ago, but now it's like, goddamn, Spielberg is like the master of the inset shot and a master of the visual storytelling. Like, I don't even know how. Like, there's this one scene in the movie where I think it's at the end, like on one of the final Christmases, where he got arrested in Paris. He got extradited back to America. He escaped from the plane on the tarmac of the JFK International Airport, runs home to his mom's house. But then the cops saw, and like, or maybe it's the but there's the POV shot of Frank where he's like kind of like you desperately like glancing around trying to look for a way out, doesn't see any. Like, he's just so good at doing that stuff that like you don't even notice it, but it does so much to like put you in the POV. It's a POV shot, put you into the POV of Frank Abagnale. It's great.
Yeah, that plane escape scene is so good. And Tom Hanks is excellent. Like, when he's climbing, one of my favorite shots in this whole movie is he's climbing into the toilet cavity on this airplane shouting, "Frank!" He's like, I don't know. He goes all the way in too. He's committed.
Yeah. Yeah.
You talked about,
he can't be humiliated again. This kid's humiliated him on like three separate occasions. And like, can you imagine the humiliation here?
Yeah. But yeah, Steven Spielberg is so good. And I wonder, so there are a few shots in this movie where Frank Jr. is shown like peeling bottles off of labels. And then at the end when, or toward the end when, you know, he's at the New Orleans estate, whatever, and they're there to hunt him down, and he's upstairs panicking with the bags of money, or, you know, briefcases of money. Tom Hanks picks up one of the bottles that he's peeled the label off of and looks at it. And I get the feeling that like they're doing more with these labels than just, oh, this is a trail that we know, you know, Frank pulls labels off bottles. It's more like representative of what he's doing in his life. Like he's peeling the labels off of himself, right? Becoming nothing to become anything he wants. Or like, it's also reminiscent of a lot of the techniques that he used to forge checks, right? Like peeling labels off of the planes to put onto the checks, just peeling numbers, scratching numbers off of checks, letters and stuff like that. It all feels like of a piece to me.
Yeah. I also think that like, because I was trying, because there's so many emphasis on him peeling labels off of things. And I thought like, I didn't even get it from that, but I'm also like, well, maybe that's like practice, you know, like, like if you practice picking locks, I hear the people that do it professionally, the guys on YouTube, like they'll literally have locks in their lap while they're watching TV and they're just picking locks all the time. Like cuts pictures out of things and gets cellophane off of things. And like, he's like, if he sees a label, he just like, you know, unconsciously starts peeling it to try to get it perfectly off, just because that's like a useful skill that he's just practicing in kind of a mechanical way.
Mm-hmm.
But it also works in the layer type situation. Let's pause here and take a quick break.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Okay, we're back, and I have a question. Were there any points in the movie that like you started to get uncomfortable with the scam? Because I've got a couple.
Not with the scam itself necessarily, but I got uncomfortable when I sat down to watch this movie, because a thing I had forgotten about this movie is he's supposed to be like 16. In this movie,
right.
And I remembered that he made love to several women in this movie.
Yeah,
and every time I was like, "Oh no!" He gets paid $400 to sleep with Jennifer Garner at one point, and I was like, "Oh God, you don't know what you're in for here."
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, I don't. That's an interesting moral calculus, because that's one of the scenes that made me uncomfortable from a position of like, because like. I clearly remember when I saw that movie, like, yeah, fuck yeah, this is cool. There's this, you know, hooker, and she's trying to, like, inflate the numbers up and take advantage. And he's like, you know, they have this, like, repeating thing where every time he suggests doing one thing and the person that he's scamming tells him, well, actually, you should just go do here and you'll get more. And he's like, even better.
Yeah.
And when he's negotiating with her and he's like, you want $1,000 on have the $1,400 check. And she's like, well, I'll just pay you $400 cash and you give me the check. And he's like, even better. The backstory of Jennifer Garner's character is that she was like a child model and like a failed actor that has kind of, crashed and flamed and is now, you know, sex working, hooking on the side to like make ends meet. You know, trading on like, you know, how much time can a woman sell her body? Like, that's the sad truth. Like, there's a shelf life to that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And like it kind of curdled the scene a little bit that he is taking advantage of essentially the female version of him. You know,
sure.
like at the end of the day, yeah, she paid this kid $400 to sleep with her. And that felt like, because again, most of the people he takes advantage of are faceless corporations that have lots of money. They're probably taking advantage of tons of people. I'm not saying this that makes the morality right. I'm just saying that it's what makes it, you know, watchable. It's like this is why he's not Al fucking Capone, right?
Yeah.
He's not machine gunning people. He's not stealing from old ladies and all that. But this is like the one scheme that made me cringe. And also poor Amy Adams.
Yeah.
You know, who is another person who, much like him, is a youth that made a few mistakes, if you want to call them that, has been disowned by her parents, is like working as a candy striper, volunteer at this hospital to try to like get a job to make ends meet, not having very success with that. This guy comes in, sweeps her off her feet, fixes her relationship with her parents, worms their way into the family, and then drops this fucking bomb. And the idea, like when I was watching the scene the next day at the airport where he's like, you know, you got to go to Miami International and you got to take this and you got to do all that. And she's done it all. And he's like, it's worked out. But then he starts seeing the fingerprints of the FBI in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
I felt sad because I feel like Amy Adams' character is going to blame herself forever for this guy running away. Because, you know, her parents probably leaned on her to working with the cops, and she probably is always going to imagine, first of all, the way her dad and mom are, probably going to blame her for being so stupid.
100%.
Going to blame them for embarrassing the family. She's going to be right back outside the family, and she's going to always think about, oh my God, what if I was in Brazil with the love of my life? Which probably was always just a fantasy.
Yeah.
But those are the times where I felt like, God damn, the victim is not a faceless corporation. It's a real human being that's in a pitiable state, and you're fucking them. Yep. Sometimes, literally.
Right.
And that's where it's like, yeah, it's like, I didn't notice that as a 24-year-old man, but as a 44-year-old man, I'm like, oh, damn, that kind of sucks, dude. That's rough.
Yeah. No, it's one thing to, you know, take advantage of bank teller for like a night, right? Get two checks cashed and one roll in the hay. It's another thing to essentially cement this girl's status in her family as the black sheep.
I don't know, like,
you come back from this with a guy like Martin Sheen plays in this movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They pivot from there, right? It goes back to the fun and games, right? Right back into, oh, well, we're going to create this Pan Am recruit program, and that's going to be my shield to get into the airport and out of the country. And
which is also kind of gross. He's using these women. They're the pinstripes on the Yankee uniform that everybody can't help but look at. Yeah,
absolutely. And the way that they like play with time here is interesting. Like Spielberg just kind of rolls it from the day that Amy Adams is supposed to show up and meet him and run away with him into what must be weeks of preparation, right? And the whole time we're seeing it as if it's one contiguous thing at the airport. And on his side, we're seeing sort of these chopped up weeks. And then he comes back probably weeks later and makes his escape.
See, I don't know that I agree with that. Like, I know it stretches the credibility, but I kind of think you're supposed to feel like that he called up the high school, say, I'm a pilot recruiter from Pan Am, call a convocation for me, show up that day, grab the girls with the uniform. Like, I think he had like that ready to go, because like, it doesn't make sense for them to stake out Miami International for weeks in this context, because Frank could be halfway around the country. He like, you know, but.
Well,
but also doesn't make sense for Frank to do that. It's a
to Carl.
There's
right?
an arrogance. Says, there's a defiance.
He's not in
New
York because I'm not in New York, right?
Right.
Like, I'm not in whatever.
And an arrogance to Frank, because he could go to any fucking airport in the country within an easy drive of this place, and he chooses to go like, I'm going like, yeah, yeah. I'm going to show you people. You're ready for me. There's a lot of defiance. Like, one of my favorite scenes is Tom Hanks defiantly eating an eclair.
I was sitting there during that screen yelling at the screen, eat it all, you coward. Eat it. Put it in your mouth.
I want you to go Bill Murray and Groundhog Day. Just this middle-aged man throwing caution to the wind. Just like eat this eclair in this little kid's face.
It's just got one bite left.
Right. But like, every time I started feeling bad about Leo, I just like they have a scene that reminds me of like he is I don't know if you can say a victim of circumstance, but I also don't think that you can call like an 18-year-old like a free moral agent, especially if they've been living the last 3 years on the lam. Like that one Christmas, I think it was the third Christmas, he calls Carl and he says, I just want this to be over. Stop chasing me. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. And he's like, you've stolen $4 million. Like,
right.
What do you think is going to happen? And there's another scene like this keeps escalating, like, you know, they go to his parents, they're like, oh, how much trouble he could be. And the mom is like, oh, yeah, I've been working the Sunday bake sale. I got a little bit of extra money. I'll just write a check. How much do I owe you? And he's like, it's at $3.1 million and climbing. And she's just like fucking stunned because, yeah, there's no way you're walking out of here scot free. And, you know, this movie is also structured brilliantly. Starts with like this. What is that? The mystery date game. And like it's like a nice setup for like, you know, this guy being a confidence man. You almost forget by the end of the movie that it starts this way, and then it slams to, you know, I think we've talked about this in Un Profit, or wasn't it, about like, man, prisons around the world are scary places. Mm-hmm. Like, I know America's got its problems, but holy shit, this rat infested dungeon that they got him thrown in France was especially scary. They're not giving him access to doctors, etc. And you just keep remembering, like, this is just a kid. It's really effective. And again, Spielberg's so good because, like, this is I'm thinking about all these stuff as very heavy subjects, but this film never is buoyed down by them.
It never
sinks and stops moving forward and being fun because he's just so good at this. He's so good at setting the tone and dealing with this stuff and making you love it, making you love watching the film. I also really liked at the end when Leo's kind of run out of room, he run out of rope. He's at Mont Richard, his mom's old village. And he's got this like 2-ton industrial check printing process. He's going to make himself a fucking fraudulent billionaire by the and Tom Hanks walks in alone, shuts it down. And like Frank sees the con everywhere. Mm-hmm. Oh, you want me to cuff yourself? Oh, you got your squad outside. Oh, they're going to kill me. Oh, it's a good scam for it, but I'm not buying it. You're going to have to catch me. And Tom Hanks is pleading with him. It's like, these people are angry. There's no due process here. I'm here as a courtesy. If you run out of this building, you're going to get cut down by a bunch of angry French people. And it's weird because it is a confidence scam in a way. Like, to get this person who's so distrustful, is always looking for the angle to actually believe you. Like, no, son, I'm actually trying to save your life. And he does. And there's that split second where even I'd forgotten when they walk out to the empty square. And I'm like, oh, fucking Tom rolled this guy.
It's hard.
And
to
then
say.
Like,
yeah, because they put
then
up.
all the police come in and like, yeah, like, no, I obviously. Yeah, he would have gotten beaten, shot. Who knows? Like, this is a manhunt. That, you know, had not happened before now, because I think he's 21 at this point. So like from French, he's no longer an adorable child that he's been chasing. And oh, he's Barry Allen from the Flash comic books. This is just an adult that came from America and is stealing from their countrymen and then running an international check fraud scheme. And he's going to get big people punishment. And it's sad. It's sad, but really effective is just how like. I don't know. There's a lot of shades and like, I wish I could watch this movie 3 more times because there's really something they're doing with the relationship between him and Christopher Walken and him and Tom Hanks. Like his final meeting is a lot more frantic and, you know, adrenaline packed, but like there's a lot of Frank meeting his dad for lunch with that energy bringing in to Frank getting brought in by Carl at well, I guess second to last time. And then, yeah, the other thing is, like, I think they also sold the genuine kind of friendship and camaraderie that Carl and Frank felt over the years. Apparently, that's legit. Like, it's something that I said in many sources that, like, these guys were friends, you know, got to be kind of close. I don't know. Again, don't know how much of this stuff is true. I guess a lot of the actual crime details, because one of the other things I saw Frank David interview in 2015 talking about this, and he asserted, of course, again, confidence man, that the FBI, he wasn't involved in making the movie, but the FBI was, because the FBI was kind of concerned that they came off looking well and didn't look like fools and all that stuff. And I guess a lot of the crime stuff was kind of signed off by the FBI. So,
which they make him look a little inept. Even Hanratty at times looks foolish. You know, I mean, it starts like the first encounter he has with Frank. He's made to look like an extreme fool. But then, like, also, they're not taking their job seriously. They don't know how to work the projector. I can't tell if it's like underfunding or just incompetence that we're talking about. Like, is that a busted projector that they're fighting with, or is that an idiot who doesn't know how to operate a simple projector?
I think a little bit, because, like, yeah, you get this idea this bank fraud is just like the no one. This is where they send. This is like that department underground in season one of The Wire, where they just send all the burnouts and rejects and the people that, you know, got in trouble with the department supervisors. This is like, you don't get to chase bank robbers. You don't get to work kidnapping. You're just chasing down routing numbers now, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And again, that's the thing, is like, I don't ever think Tom Hanks looked like a fool. I mean, he kind of does, but like, that's that Secret Service thing was so seat of his pants and so ballsy that, like, I can see a lot of people getting, because the thing and what made it work is, like, you can see Tom Hanks is like, I'm not taking a gun off you. This is a bunch of shit. And then he's like, oh, there's my partner taking the guy into custody. And it, like, what are the odds, you know? And then he's like, hey, Murph. And these guys, like, he looks up. He's like, yeah, to make sure the LAPD know we're blah. It's, I mean, what would you do? Like, you, at some point, like, because there's, again, you know, and that's, this works against them sometimes in law enforcement, there is this kind of like camaraderie, and it's kind of like rude to suspect your brothers in arms. And like, it's like, are you going to be the asshole that looks at my ID after all this? And if you are that asshole and you're wrong, you're never going to live it down. You're already working in a joke department. But yeah, he does get humiliated, but like only in the eyes of his boss, because as a person watching the movie, I always felt like, well, this is a cat and mouse game, and you're chasing a really smart cat. Mm-hmm. Or I'm sorry, you're chasing a really smart mouse. But it's a good movie. It's a real fun one. It's like, I couldn't believe after it was done, because I'm like, oh, I'm going to have, because I didn't look at the runtime. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have like 2.5-3 hours this morning to do stuff. And at the end, it's like, oh, I only have an hour and a half before this call, because this movie is 2.5 hours long. Holy shit.
No.
Yeah.
It never feels like that. It feels like a standard feature length film. Hour and a half, hour 40.
Yeah, I was thinking, something like that. An hour 45, but like 2.5 hour movie, and it does not feel like it. It's definitely worth your guys' time. It's coming up on its 20th anniversary. Had a lot of good memories for me. And it's really, again, really great performances from very young people that you're going to be seeing a lot of, you know, in the coming decade or two. So that's it for Catch Me If You Can. We caught it. We could. We did. You also caught my respect, Leo, in this movie. Next time we're going to be doing on Bald Move Prestige, the Social Network. I don't know if you guys know, but Facebook has become a thing. There's been a lot of years between this movie and where we're at in present day. I haven't seen this movie since it came out in theaters, and I remember really liking it. This was post-Bald Move, but pre us doing like movies and television shows. So like, I'm very curious to see how this portrayal of Zuckerberg and his company has aged in the past 15 years or so. It'll be very interesting. Hope you join us for that one. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you, everybody.